Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags. I've got a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We're live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Tuesday, the 30th of April. Coming up on the program, the presidency on the security vetting of the SABC's editor-in-chief. Gains or losses for South African workers 30 years into democracy. How the two-pot retirement system could benefit the hospitality industry. Genetic variations and the impact on therapeutic drugs. And South Africa's looming natural gas dry-up and the consequences. Let's start with this. And Vincent Magwenya, who speaks for the president, has denied that executives of the SABC, including the chief executive and the head of news, Moshweshwe Manare, who are being vetted by the state security agency, are being targeted ahead of the general election. Now, here's the background. Manare was requested by the SSA on the 18th of April to be vetted again and undergo a top security test that would include the taking of a polygraph. Magwenya joins me now on MoneyWeb at Midday. And firstly, can the presidency clarify the specific reasons behind the timing of the request, particularly given its proximity to the upcoming general election? It does seem odd.
No, Jeremy, he was not targeted ahead of the elections. You and I have both worked at the SABC and we know how the system works there. Targeting him will have not delivered any results and will have not made any sense. More importantly, targeting journalists is not what we do in this country. We have a Bill of Rights, specifically Section 16(1), that protects media freedom, that protects the right of expression. Therefore, something of this nature will be foreign in our body politic and in our government.
The reality, though, is the timing is very odd, given that it's with a month to go before the election. Why now?
Well, the information that we have in terms of our understanding is that he was never conducted by anybody from the SSA on the date that he claims to have been conducted. That's number one. Number two, his vetting process started when he commenced with his employment at the SABC, which he consented to. That process went on. He submitted some documentation, not all. And the process then stalled when he refused to submit himself to a polygraph test.
The conventional wisdom is suggesting at the moment that the ANC is concerned about the way in which the public broadcaster is either reporting or is going to report the election, and this is simply a preemptive move. What does the presidency say to that?
No, Jeremy, that will not be necessarily accurate. The SABC has been quite objective and in some cases very critical of government, including the president. That's something we observed some time ago. Raising it now, a month ahead of the elections, will not change anything. We don't believe that when we are aggrieved by coverage, you then need to interfere with management of newsrooms. What do we do when we are unhappy about coverage? We engage those editors and those journalists. And it happens across all newsrooms. It's not specifically confined to the SABC. So that assertion will not be necessarily accurate and logical for that matter, because if you have an issue with the SABC, it's not an issue that will be resolved overnight. And it will have to be an issue that is specific to a particular matter or story. not broadly where you will start tinkering with the leadership of the newsroom. Jeremy, you know that in terms of day-to-day editorial decision-making, the group executive for news is very removed in terms of levels of responsibility. There's the news editor, there is the political editor, there are senior reporters, executive producers. Therefore, in terms of what goes on air day-to-day, that's not within the ambit of the editor-in-chief from a practical point of view.
Does the presidency maintain confidence in the ability of the public broadcaster under current leadership to deliver fair and unbiased coverage of the upcoming election?
Absolutely, Jeremy, we do.
At any point, was there a discussion between the state security agency and the presidency around the vetting process?
No, we never had that discussion. What happens is that public institutions that require the executives to be vetted, as those executives are onboarded, those institutions then write to the state security agency requesting that a vetting process be conducted. So in this particular case, it was the SABC on its own volition that made the request for this particular executive to be vetted, just like it did with his predecessor, as well as it did, or currently it's doing with the new group CEO, Ms. Nomsa Chabeli, who's currently going through a vetting process and will go through a polygraph test as standard.
The Daily Maverick is reporting today that Moshoeshoe Monari himself is outraged by the security agency's demand for the vetting and has refused to make himself available for further vetting. What would the presidency's response be to that report?
It will be difficult to understand what his outrage is. He refused the polygraph test some time ago, not now. It's difficult to understand what is it that he's afraid of and what is it that he is hiding. Conducting a polygraph test does not in any way influence your decision making, does not in any way compromise your ability to exercise your judgment as well as leadership responsibility. So it's a bit puzzling as to what this newly found outrage is about.
The president has also said, and you've just said to me, that no part of your administration is going to sanction acts of intimidation or harassment of journalists. But you will concede that as a result of this particular incident, there is now a climate almost of hostility between the SABC and the presidency. How do you plan to resolve that?
Not quite. There's none. I engage SABC reporters that cover the president and that cover government on a daily basis. There is no hostility whatsoever. I engage the political editor at the SABC on a regular basis. There is no hostility. In fact, I spoke to Mzwandile yesterday. I was on the phone with some of the colleagues there on Sunday. There's no hostility. There is an issue with one individual that is objecting to a vetting process, and that issue must be confined to that individual and be dealt as such. But with respect to the entire institution, I know of no hostility based on my regular and daily dealings with the SABC.
Vincent Magwenya, thank you very much indeed for talking to me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, let's move now from broadcasting to labour matters. And many workers will tomorrow be reflecting on their lives and livelihood 30 years into democracy. And if on Worker Day their lives are better off. Matthew Parks is the parliamentary coordinator for COSATU and is well positioned, I think, to answer questions on that and also the future difficulties and challenges that face organized labor. Matthew Parks, good afternoon to you. So looking back over the past three decades, do you really think the quality of life for South African workers has changed any?
No, definitely it has changed. And I think often, and look, it's natural to forget the progress we've achieved. You know, before 1994, if you looked under the apartheid era in the 1980s, workers were treated little better than slaves in terrible conditions. If they dared raise the voice and complaint, they'd be met with police brutality. That time, we used to see about every single day, at least one mine worker, for example, dying in an accident at work. Now we have a democracy. We've got clear labor laws. People can raise their grievances. There's ways to channel them and how to resolve them. And on many fronts, we've seen progress. mothers have paid maternity leave. More recently, fathers have paid parental leave. We have unemployment and injury on duty insurance. The number of mine workers, for example, has gone down from dying one a day to about one a week. So I think there's many progress, areas of progress. More recently, we have seen a national minimum wage being introduced, which has raised the wages of 6 million workers. And of course, the legacy of apartheid are being, you know, systematically eradicated. And whilst we appreciate all of those positive things, we must also not just be complacent or just sit on our laurels.
Yet,
we have a 41%
Matthew,
unemployment rate.
Yet South Africa's workforce still finds itself in very difficult economic circumstances right now. Where do you think policy and reform is falling short?
So we've managed to achieve, you know, good progress on the political, the legislative front. The challenge now, as you're saying, is addressing the economic issues, which are very painful. No one in a sober mind can celebrate a 41% unemployment rate. We still have the scars of entrenched poverty and inequality, and those need to be tackled. I think for us, the policies are fine. It's about growing the economy. We've got to remove the obstacles. So that means we've got to have reliable and affordable electricity. We've got to fix transport, which is critical to mining and manufacturing, agricultural sectors, which are jobs-intensive industries. We've got to fix our ports so our exports can take off. We have to deal with the really entrenched levels of crime and corruption, because that bleeds the fiscus of money. That also deters investment. We've got to look at other smart ways also about how to make our economy more competitive, because the global community doesn't have time to wait for us. It's not dealing with charity cases. It's a hard-hitting world. So I think there's progress on many fronts on the policy, but now we've got to deal with the real hard, difficult issues around the economic issues. And I think nobody can be satisfied with our levels of unemployment and so forth.
All of these aspects that you're suggesting are long-term fixes. I'd suggest to you, Matthew, though, that there is a lot of short-term frustration among South Africa's workforce, and that, I guess, as a union grouping, is the biggest problem that you've got to face right now.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you're right, there's a lot of these longer-term issues, but unfortunately, we don't have long-term. A society can't be sustained with a 41% unemployment rate or 59% youth unemployment rate. We don't have the luxury of 5 years to fix transit. We've got to fix it by yesterday. Because otherwise, as we saw during the November medium-term budget statement, where there was a 55 billion rand revenue shortfall because of the crisis of transit and the impact it has on the economy, we've got to fix it quickly. I think we are, and look, society's right to be skeptical of politicians. That's part of democracy. That's how you keep politicians in check. But I think we do see some green shoots. Not enough, but I think we do see it. I think we've seen real progress with regards to electricity. That's critical for every single workplace, whether it's a restaurant or a mining company, to be productive. We're not out of the woods yet, but I think from where we are today, where we have maybe, you know, 2 hours of load shedding now and then, as compared to last year when we hit rock bottom of 12 hours a day, which was just a calamity, we have seen some progress at transit. I think not enough to be anywhere near satisfied, but at least, let me say, a little bit of a stabilization, not a complete free fall. But I think what's been done at Eskom has got to be now escalated to transit. We've got to really make sure we fix our and secure transit freight rail, fix our ports, modernize them, and equally to Metro Rail as well. Some things are more difficult, and I think you're right, Jeremy. Some things are longer term, like how do you fix local government? The collapse of basic service in many rural towns, which has caused some companies to close. I think those are much more complicated, much more difficult. But we've got to do it, and sometimes you also have to be seen to be taking symbolic actions. So the work being done to rebuild the South African Revenue Service, dealing with tax evasion, I think that's really fantastic work. Those are the seeds of the success of the Madiba and the Mbeki administrations. I think we've actually begun to see a little bit of progress, not enough, but I think some positive green shoots around corruption and getting people into prison. At times, you don't always appreciate the kind of when you're in the middle of a storm, but if we can have a former president sentenced for contempt of court, if a speaker of the National Assembly can be compelled to resign when she's charged, I think for us, that's a bit of a sign that we are turning the corner. We are beginning to hold very powerful persons accountable. And hopefully that's a sign that we are beginning to rebuild the state, which is critical to growing the economy. So I think it's a mixed bag on this progress, but there's also a huge amount of work we have to do.
Matthew Parks, let me pivot the conversation and ask you how a union grouping like COSATU is dealing with the new labor landscape that is starting to emerge. For instance, things like artificial intelligence and the gig economy, which will inevitably result in job losses.
It's a difficult thing, and I think unions across the world are really struggling with it. I don't think anyone has really come to grips with what are the solutions. Some of it is quite complicated things, like unions need to be much smarter on how they organize. It's difficult. I mean, we've seen a lot of workers, for example, call center workers nowadays work from home. So how do you physically access such a person? That's one difficulty. A lot of workers who might have had a permanent job at a pension or insurance fund as an investment broker are now told, well, you're self-employed. So it's quite difficult. We also can see many jobs will be changed, will be replaced by AI. And I think we need to also put pressure on how we skill workers for the jobs, not just of today, but the jobs of tomorrow. So we avoid creating deep structural unemployment. Some of the issues we're also looking at is at NEDLAC about how do we update our labor laws, because our labor laws were designed for a Monday to Friday factory job, formal employment. They need to be more agile and modernized to accommodate different types of work. Yes, you accommodate the formal employment of the factory, but also you need to cover the atypical employment, the Uber driver, the artist, the musician, maybe a worker who's got two or three jobs, and so forth, because the model of one size fits all no longer works. It's going to be increasingly diversified, and we've got to make sure we're agile to keep pace with it. But I think the bottom line is unions remain relevant as long as workers have challenges, and workers will always have
All
difficulties.
right. Matthew Parks, I am going to leave it there. Parliamentary coordinator for COSATU, thank you indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, as we move on, I want to stay with workplace issues, and my next guest, Nicolette van Vuren, who's a partner at Weber Wenzel, says the two-pot retirement system that allows people to withdraw a limited amount of money from their pension savings could be of benefit to many in the financially challenged hospitality industry. She joins me now on the program. And first up, Nicolette, welcome. And how does the system then benefit employees in the sector, which we know has high staff turnover rates?
You know what? I think it is to prevent employees from leaving retirement, I mean, from leaving employment. As you'll know, no employee was able to leave employment or to get access to their pension fund money whilst they were still employed. So, yes, there is going to be a mechanism for them to access a portion of their retirement fund savings if they leave employment whilst still saving for retirement.
And the hospitality industry generally is one of those that always seems to be sitting on a knife edge. So I would imagine the more security anyone can have in that respect is going to work to their advantage.
Absolutely. So, you know, what this system is actually going to do is it's going to give them an access to a small portion. So it's going to be one third of their contributions from the 1st of September, plus the amount that will be seeded, which will be 10% of their current savings or to a maximum of 30,000 rand. So they will have access to that portion once a year. And it was intended that it would be for emergency situations. However, you don't have to give a reason for the withdrawal. You can just access that money. So yes, there will be access to a limited portion of money, and the balance, the two thirds of the contributions, will be saved to retirement. The current savings that they have will go into a pot that will be called the vested pot, and that will be subject to the current rules of the fund. So again, if they leave employment, they will have access to that amount, but during employment, they will be able to access the savings portion.
Given South Africa's propensity to spend and our poor savings track record, there's huge risk attached to this whole process, though, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely. Well, from a member point of view, definitely. You know, I think a lot of members are thinking that on the 1st of September, they'll have access to 30,000 rand, which is a problem in itself because the majority of members may not even have that amount saved up. You know, 10% of 20,000 is 2,000 rand, and the minimum withdrawal is 2,000 rand. So anything under that, they're not going to be able to withdraw on the 1st of September in any event. And more than that, that amount, whatever they withdraw, is subject to their marginal tax rate. So, you know, and subject to a tax directive. So if there's any money owing to SARS, that may be deducted from that amount that they want to withdraw. And also the tax will be deducted. So for an employer, there's a huge risk taking that money out. The intention of the two-pot system is to ensure retirement and is to ensure savings for retirement. So yes, there will be a two-third portion that will be forced, and you won't have access to a lump sum on that amount even at retirement. But again, the savings amount that you're going to withdraw, you're not going to receive the full amount that you think you're going to get out.
You're obviously monitoring the situation very closely. There is also the concern, is there not, that there is going to be a run on pension funds and the industry itself is maybe logistically not ready for this. What's your view on that?
I think, look, the administration companies have been preparing for this for a long time. I know we had the Pension Lawyers Conference in April, and there was a lot of discussion about it. And like I say, they've been preparing for it for a couple of years now. Yes, we haven't seen final legislation, but in recent months, the legislation and the bills that have been coming through has really been tweaked. So I think the majority of the administration companies are ready. Whether the regulator is going to be ready, that is still to be seen. You know, all the funds, once we get the final legislation, have to still do all their rule amendments. They have been given guidance from the regulator as to what to do with these rule amendments, and you can send them into the regulator to just confirm that you're on the right track. But I do think there is going to be a massive run on anything in the retirement industry on the 1st of September. It's going to be chaos, I think, you know, with members wanting to withdraw on that day. I know Kasatu has been pushing for maximum amounts to be ceded so that their members can have access to cash. So I do think there is going to be a bit of chaos from the 1st of September for a while until the industry settles into this new system.
What is your specific concern about the regulator and where the deficiencies might be?
I think it's the approval of the rules, because the rules are the constitution of a fund, and nothing can happen if the rules don't provide for it. So at the moment, the registered rules of the fund wouldn't provide for it, because there's no legislation directing that a fund has to do that. So every single fund has to now amend their rules upon receipt of the final legislation. And a lot of the funds have been, you know, drafting rules in accordance with what the current bills are saying. So it may just be a few final tweaks that they have to do. But all of those rules are then going to have to be sent to the FSCA to be registered. I know they have geared up with more staff to address this, but I think there may be a delay in getting these rules approved. And the withdrawals can only happen once the rules have finally been approved by the regulator. So I think that's where there may be a delay in the whole process.
Nicolette van Vuren from Weber Wenzel, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's industrial users of gas energy are calling on government to intervene urgently to avoid a gas shortage. That's when Sasol suspends supplies to the industry in 2 years. More now from Jaco Human, who is executive officer at the Industrial Gas Users Association. Jaco, we've had this conversation before, and I'm assuming that your association is getting more concerned.
I think we are, as time goes on. You know, when we talked earlier in the year, it is true, Jeremy, that we've highlighted the extreme timelines that we have, or the narrow window in which we need to make certain key decisions. That is narrowing, of course, as time goes by, and industry will have to make some form of commitment probably around about July, August this year. Now, during this period, I mean, we've had engagements with government at various levels and within the state machinery, but it's very difficult to gauge what the outcome or commitments may or may not be from the state.
I want to ask you in a moment what commitments you're specifically seeking, but maybe just give me a sense of what a shortage of gas would actually mean for the country and for the economy.
Manufacturing sector reliant on gas represent the backbone of the manufacturing sector. I mean, you're really talking here about steel, ceramics, FMCG goods, food, the bread that we eat, the beverages that we drink, the bricks that we build our homes with. So the mining industry, the aluminium sector, and so on and so forth. And the absence of gas, particularly in the scale that we utilize gas, there are no sort of discernible alternative that we see to substitute natural gas. So we are literally faced with plant closures or downscaling of production, significant downscaling of production. So the risks are real, and we simply need to find a solution. What we're asking government to do, the second point of your question, is we simply asking government to come on this journey with us and take some of the residual risk in these commitments that industry need to make on large infrastructure projects, which are typically utility scale type projects. And we're also asking government to play a significant role or an unlocking role in the gas to power sector. In other words, that which they control, particularly on the gas demand side, to supplement the industrial demand for gas in order to make things more bankable and feasible.
Is it your sense that government is not listening to you, that it's not taking this issue with the degree of seriousness that it should?
My sense is that government is listening, right? But we unfortunately not getting a sense of where we're heading with this. You know, we've had various engagements now on a platform which the DTIC is coordinating with all relevant stakeholders, whether it's Eskom, the DMRE, the the IDC, NERSA as regulator, Transnet, for example. But we don't see a North Star here yet.
So inevitably we would have to look at export, and that's going to add huge cost.
We would have to look at importation.
Import, I beg your pardon, not export, yep.
Correct. So we simply don't have an alternative because the God-given domestic resource, gas resource that we have, although in our neighboring country, Mozambique, is now depleted, right? So industry is ready to shift to this more expensive alternative, but that's going to certainly come at a cost to the economy, without a doubt.
What about the recent discovery of gas fields off the Eastern Cape Coast? I would imagine that would be a help, but it's a long-term help.
The East Coast, we have significant discoveries that we see playing out at our neighboring countries, being that on the East Coast, Mozambique, up north, of course, and what is playing out there. But more recently, very close to our borders is the Orange Basin, where the Orange River flows out into the Atlantic Ocean. Namibia, there are significant announcements, and we expect Namibia to become a gas hub, supply hub on a global basis in a very short period of time. South Africa certainly has the same potential. We see that the gas master plan, which has now been published, actually is very light on the exploration potential for gas. And a gas master plan, in our view, needs to be quite comprehensive, you know, talking about gas sources, domestic exploration, and of course the demand and supply side for consumption. So I think we are behind from a South African perspective to our neighboring countries, Mozambique and Namibia, for sure.
Where do you believe the exploration potential lies in South Africa right now?
We actually have a shovel-ready resource in the form of Leopard Brulpadda. It is linked to the potential demand for gas by Petro SA, but that project is not moving. So we have almost a sterilized resource. It is the only bulk gas, natural gas resource available to us in the project, of course, backed by Total Energy. There are further exploration potential, significant, just south of the Orange, or within the Orange Basin, just south of the Namibian border. And it is there which South Africa should focus its exploration potential. It would be great to have domestic, on-land, inland gas resources available. That is probably the most cost-efficient. We're sitting with significant shale gas potential. But these will take, if they take out off, will take a decade or two to capitalize on. Offshore is definitely where the big potential sits in over the medium term.
And that's where we'll leave it. Jaco Human, Executive Officer at the Industrial Gas Users Association of South Africa, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And finally on the program, the concept of pharmacogenomics, the study of how genetic variations influence an individual's response to therapeutic drugs, is important, and my next guest says holds immense promise for healthcare by facilitating personalized treatments tailored to an individual's genetic makeup. I'm joined now by Professor Kelly Chibali, the Neville Isdell Chair in African-Centric Drug Discovery and Development at the University of Cape Town. Professor, a very good afternoon to you, and a warm welcome. Is this a debate about a good database or about cost and affordability?
Well, Jeremy, thank you very much. And thanks for having me. Good afternoon to you and to the listeners. This is a health equity issue. It's a health equity issue because historically medicines have not, in the African context, not been optimized for the African patient populations, principally for two reasons. One, we have such a low volume of clinical trials on the African continent. You know, we make up 15% of the world's population, and you know, we account for 20% of the disease burden, and yet we don't have that many clinical trials, you know, 3 to 4% of the global clinical trials. And then the other reason is that in the discovery of medicines, we don't have, you know, tools that will allow us to prioritize medicines based on the predicted profile in African patients who represent the most genetically diverse population on this planet.
And the impact of that is what? In other words, what is the continent missing out on because of this deficit that you've outlined?
The immediate consequence is obviously one of health equity. In other words, suboptimal medicines where the efficacy is not optimal, and then of course also adverse events in terms of toxicity, because, you know, how one individual metabolizes a medicine, you know, whether it's too quickly or too slowly, has major implications on treatment outcomes. So that's what Africa is missing on. We have suboptimal medicines that are not optimized for this very diverse, genetically diverse African patient population.
Are we able to skip a beat here and solve the problem using artificial intelligence?
Precisely. This is exactly the point. But I think before one can even think about that, we have to get the basics in place. And the basics for artificial intelligence are, number one, access to affordable and reliable electricity. It's a no-brainer. Because, you know, these supercomputers rely on energy, you know, to power these very complex AI models and data. So that's the first requirement. The second requirement is access to affordable digital infrastructure, access to the internet. And then finally, data. We need granular data. But yes, there is something that we can use already based on the available data that's been generated on the African patient population. And that's where we are using AI to help us leapfrog this barrier of not having sufficient data by borrowing from what has been learned in other areas. We call it transfer learning. So we can work with small data sets and use learnings from other areas, especially in the cancer field, where this has been done tremendously in the developed world.
I am going to leave it there. Professor Kelly Chibale from the University of Cape Town, thank you very much for joining us. And just before I leave you, on our last online poll, we spoke about election security. I asked if you were confident in the SAPS, if you were worried, or if more deployment was needed. Over 50% of our respondents say they are concerned with a month to go before the poll. Today, security vetting on the SABC editor-in-chief. It was our lead story. My question to you, necessary, sinister, or do you need more clarity on the situation? If you have a view on that, please go to MoneyWeb on Twitter, X, or on our LinkedIn page. MoneyWeb at midday, live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.